Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.
Hello, my name is Frank Calabrese Jr. I am from Chicago. I was born and raised in Chicago. I am half Irish and half Italian. I followed my father and my uncle into the Chicago mob. I have written a book about my life. It's called Operation Family Secrets. It was number 14 on the New York Times bestseller list. I now have a tour. I am the tour guide. It's FamilySecretsTours.com. It runs in Chicago. And I want you to come on out, and I'll tell you firsthand about the life in Chicago outfits. You are listening to Gangland Wire.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. Welcome to the Classic Old Ice House in Midtown Kansas City, within just a few blocks of several mob hits. Great neighborhoods around here. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
If you remember last week, we talked about Tommy and Rose Maria Uva, who were the star characters in the movie Rob the Mob, which is on Netflix right now. I highly recommend, if you haven't seen it, that you go watch it. And if you have seen it and it's been a while, maybe you saw it when it first came out, go watch it again. That's what I did. I wanted my wife to see it. And when I saw it was on Netflix, I said, we got to watch this. And it inspired me. I said, I got to do this story. And I actually already created a file and started gathering some information on these two guys because I thought it was such a great story.
And you told her that?
What?
About how you want to do this story.
Yeah.
Because I know she's not a big fan of the program.
No.
She that's why we do it here.
She doesn't listen to the program.
That's a Big Dumb Fun Show social club.
Really. Yeah, this is our social club, the Big Dumb Fun Show social club, Studio 4. That's what we could, this is Studio 4 with our Chicago, City Chicago flag here, because we're like a kind of part of the Chicago outfit, and we're part of the Kansas City outfit, and so
Ben Ellickson from Chicago sent us a flag.
Thanks, Ben. We always like to mention our friend Ben. I had a little interchange with him the other day on Facebook, and he operates a great big digging machine. I think I mentioned one time how he was doing some archaeological work with his machine. He found an empty bottle down in an excavation. He was able to use the bucket of this. The bucket was about 3 foot wide and about 3 foot deep, and he could pick up a glass bottle and carry it over out of the hole he was digging and dump it down without breaking it. So he's a very talented dude. So I said, you know, if I ever need a body to bury, to get rid of, I know who to go to. You can dig a hell of a hole and bury it deep.
Yeah.
So he came back. He said, I could just leave the body in the car. I'll bury the whole car for you. So this is a good guy to know if you need a body that's gonna needs to be buried.
Yeah. Well, the last thing you want him to do is damage the body after it's dead.
Well, you might need to get rid of the car. That way it'd look like that the guy just drove off somewhere.
Yeah.
He's not really dead. He just drove on a vacation and never came back. He's like in the Springsteen song. And I took a right turn and kept on going. So, you know, I mean, thanks, Ben. That's a hell of an idea.
There's a lot of guys out there that they took a right turn and apparently kept going.
Kept on going, yeah.
Never got found.
Sal Manzo right here in Kansas City. Another dude named Paul. I can't remember his last name. I can see his face. He had a 1976 Lincoln Continental Mark III, IV, whatever year that was. And it was blue. It was robin's egg blue with a white vinyl top. And all of a sudden, him and that car disappeared. Now, I don't think he did, got disappeared in the car. His family probably just sold it. But he definitely, all of a sudden, never showed up anywhere again, and nobody ever inquired about him. He wasn't very well liked. Nobody ever inquired about him either. You know, what we talked about last week, we want to finish that story up because the second part of it was actually how this crime spree by Rosemarie and Tommy Uva robbing mafia social clubs in New York City. He robbed the Gotti Club, Bergen Fish and Game Club, robbed several other of those clubs, and he always he humiliated these guys. I think in one case he had this Uzi that he was using, and he got it under control. You know, the first robbery, he fired off a burst, and the gun started rising up on him, and he couldn't get it to quit shooting. But he tried to pistol whip one of the guys with it, and knocked his toupee off. And he always made the guys take their pants off, or at least drop them down around their ankles so he couldn't chase him out the door. And he was humiliating these guys. And, I mean, they were... they were beating the bushes. They were desperately trying to find who these people were.
It's bad enough that he's robbing them, let alone humiliating them.
Well,
they weren't going to go to the cops.
Nobody ever went to the cops.
And these guys were fearless, not because they were just that fearless, but because they were drug addicts.
They were drug addicts. It was, they're talking about living in the moment. They lived in the moment. They did not look ahead. They did not think about consequences. They just need to get that next rock and get it in that pipe and let it hit their lungs and then feel that overwhelming feeling of confidence and security, that warm glow of intoxication spread throughout their body. I make that sound pretty good, don't I, Aaron?
I might have. Hold on a minute. I'll be right back.
I'll be right back.
I need to be invincible. I'm walking the main streets of Kansas City.
Well, there is something about getting intoxicated on whatever it is what makes you feel invincible. 6'2" with 250 pounds with a full head of black curly hair, man, nobody will mess with you.
Well, I mean, when you're going after, you know, the Gambino crime family and hitting off their social clubs, you're, you know, the only thing you could do worse really would be to rob them at their homes.
Yeah, oh my God, oh yeah. Oh.
And you pretty much know what happens to everybody when they do that.
For sure, we know in Chicago, that's how that dude got his, was the M&M boys, I can't think of the guy, Billy something, I think it's McGee or something like that. That's how he ended up with his head in the vise, trying to get him to tell who his partner was and robbing Tony Accardo's house, or robbing houses in Tony Accardo's neighborhood. I can't remember the details exactly. It was in the movie Casino. And it really happened. Frank Collada said that Tony Spilotro told him directly. Yeah, he said, I put the dude's head in a vise, and he told me his partner's name just as one of his eyes popped out, and they killed him right after that, of course. So, yeah, we had a situation in Kansas City. A young Italian guy was burglarizing homes over in Columbus Park, and wasn't long. I was working the cases, working the burglars, and talking to these old Italian ladies who were living alone, and they'd get their TV stolen. He was a little drug addict, and we kind of heard that he might be the suspect, but we didn't really know for sure. And all of a sudden, they find his body. He's been killed, dumped in Columbus Park, in the actual park that's over there in Columbus Park. And he's still wearing some cotton gloves that he would have worn when he was breaking into houses. So that was like leaving those gloves on him or putting those gloves on him was like a sign, you know, this dude's a burglar.
Well, when they do that, as opposed to them never finding the body, I think when they do commit a murder and they leave the body where they know somebody's going to find it, it's because they're sending a message.
And sending a message. You're exactly right, Aaron. I remember Tiger Cartarella, they had his pocket slit open all the way down the side. So I think it's because he was screwing around with their money, is my understanding. So
these two guys, or this, it was actually a husband and a wife. Sorry, husband and a wife. And interestingly enough, played by Michael Pitt in the TV Netflix series.
It's not a Netflix series. It's the movie.
It's just a movie.
It's the movie that was released 4 or 5 years ago, I think, 3 years ago. So, yeah, Michael Pitt and I can't remember that woman's name.
Nina Arianda.
Arianda. And yeah, if you see it, you've seen her in TV shows. I mentioned this before. And that Michael Pitt, if you ever watched the Boardwalk Empire, he was kind of a main character for the first three or four episodes in it. A returning World War One vet who was fell in with the Steve Buscemi character, Nucky Henderson or Nucky Johnson. I can't remember his last name, Nucky. Kind of the boss of the Atlantic City area and ran all the bootlegging down there.
But this gentleman, Thomas Uva, and his girlfriend who he married, Rose Marie Ditoma?
Ditoma, that was her maiden name.
Ditoma Uva.
So,
who was the wheel woman.
Wheel woman. Now, how they got caught? We know about this whole circumstance and these robberies only for one reason, because they got caught. But here's how they got caught. These robberies all happened in March and April, May of 1992. And during this time, John Gotti was on trial. Christmas Eve, 1992, their maroon Mercury Topaz with Tommy at the wheel and Rosemarie in the passenger seat pulled up and stopped at a traffic light at Woodhaven Boulevard and 103rd Avenue in the Ozone Park neighborhood of Queens, which is Gotti territory. He lives in that exact neighborhood, and a whole lot of his compadres live in that neighborhood. Before the light can change, two men have pulled up behind them, jumped out, ran up on each side of the car, the Mercury Topaz, and emptied their handguns into the driver and the passenger. They run back to their car, and the car's still in gear, and Tommy's foot comes off the brake, of course, and it kind of, you know how if you just let the car, it'll start creeping across the intersection, hit another car that was coming along, and then came up to rest against the building. And the cops, when they get there, they'll find the lifeless body of Tommy and Rosemarie Uva in their Topaz. Police, of course, cops, you know, they don't know what's going on exactly. There's just a couple of scumbag, dope addict criminals found dead. She had $1,000 in her wallet, which would have been kind of unusual for somebody like that to have $1,000 in her wallet. Within 2 weeks of double slaying, the coppers from the 106th precinct started getting little hints and information from street informants that they had been killed in retaliation for somebody robbing social clubs. So they start looking into that. They get a search warrant for Uva's apartment. They find out where he lives, and he lived there in Ozone Park. And while they're in there, they find a billfold that belonged to a Joseph Delmonico, also known as Joe Brewer. Never heard of him. Probably a minor, kind of a mobster. He actually wasn't even a made guy. They described him as an associate of the Gambino crime family. His primary function for the crime family was he was like the business agent for Local 23 of the Mason Tenders Union, and they managed all the affairs of building laborers in Manhattan. And you know, Gotti was really into the construction rackets. In that wallet that they found, besides the identification of Joseph Delmonico, they found a folded piece of paper that listed the names and telephone numbers of numerous members of the Gambino crime family, which was at the time probably the largest numerically crime family in the United States. It's kind of interesting. And they depict something like this in the movie, although in the movie they depict this old guy, you know, Burt Young from Rocky, who was a trainer in Rocky. The one time they rob a social club and there's only three old guys in it, why, Burt Young's one of them, and he take his wallet and he tries to get, he said, just take the money. I need something out of my wallet. You know, I need my driver's license or my Medicare card or something. I don't remember what. He said, give me the wallet back. And so the guy, Tommy, started to give it back to him, and then he got impatient and something else happened. He said, you know, the heck with you. And he took the wallet with, and supposedly Burt Young or what, I can't remember his name in that, what he was a guy that, and this is fiction, he was a guy that was supposed to carry a list of mob men around with their contact information. So if anybody ever got in trouble, they could go to this guy and let other people know that they were in trouble, or if somebody else was in trouble, somebody needed help. This guy had this like phone tree kind of a list. You know what a phone tree is, Aaron? You call one person and want to call the other. So this guy had everybody's contact information. Now, the movie depicts the boss of that crew to be, when he's played by Andy Garcia. And so it shows he gets everybody together after he learns about the loss of this list, and he's mad. And the old guy, Burt Young character, does not show up at this meeting. I don't know. It's kind of a weird sort of a deal. You know, I have a list of contact information, but they're all on my cell phone. I don't keep a list of my important contacts. Everybody keeps a list of important contacts, but that's really not the thing to do when you're in a mob family, would you think?
I thought you're not supposed to write things down.
Really? I asked Tuffy about that.
Yeah, well, how'd that work out for him?
It didn't work so well, did it?
Yeah, and this guy, you know, here's Joseph Delmonico, a.k.a. Joe Brewer, with a list of mob associates' names and phone numbers. That's some gold if you're in the cop business.
So it didn't happen exactly like it did in the movie, but they did find a wallet from a Gambino crime family associate that had members of majority of that crime family with telephone numbers in there, which would be like gold for cops, because then you like go to different wiretaps. Many times you'll maybe have a PIN register going up. You know, a PIN register just takes phone numbers. Then you got to go figure out, and the phone might be, you know, it might be in your name, but yet it's a mob guy that uses it all the time. So you find that phone number that with this strange name with Aaron Gnerk's name on it, and you say, well, this dude's just a comedian and helps.
I'm just friends with the
podcast. And yeah, he works at a place where some of these mob guys might hang out, but he's not really part of it. But see, so then that you find that phone list, and it's got, you know, Anthony Pacone's name in there, and I just made that up.
Yeah, I was wondering, maybe, do you think that the list had Andrew DiDonato on it?
Andrew DiDonato's name on there and the phone number, but yet it comes by and it's been showing up on the PIN register, but it's some other guy. Then you know that's really Andrew DiDonato's contact information, so then you can start focusing on that. So
kind of wonder if Andrew might know some of these guys, Joseph Delmonico.
Well, he might. He was part of the Gambino crime family. He was a soldier, associate. I say, an associate in the crime family. He worked for that one guy that had a social club. Remember, he talked about going down to the social club. I can't remember. I don't think he ever said the name of it. So, you know, the cops, you know, you get that kind of a phone list and you wonder about it, and how this Tommy Uva end up with this? And they had the rumors about the social club robberies, and that kind of started making more sense. And they started running down the people whose names were on the list, trying to see what kind of connection there was between them and these two killings, starting to maybe figure out, you know, what clubs had been hit by these guys, because they're putting this all together. And they say this investigation created quite a little bit of confusion in the mob world in Manhattan. All these different inquiries and different people, they don't know, well, why are they coming around asking me about this? I don't know what they're talking about. And because they always, you know, compare notes and try to figure out if the cops are making some focused effort doing something, they will, you know, try to compare notes and see if they can figure out what's going on so they can cover themselves.
Well, they know they killed the right robbers when they killed...
They knew who they were killing.
Rosemarie and Thomas, they knew who they were killing. So when the cops start coming around asking questions, of course they don't know anything.
One thing that they do find, that story about the robber knocking a toupee off of one of the older gangsters. The cops by now, they know that it was something to do with the Gambino family. It was something to do with them robbing those. But they can't really put it together, and they're trying to solve the homicide, and it's not working for them. And, of course, nobody's talking. They kind of realized that the social clubs that they picked were more than the Gambinos. It was the Bonanno family and even the Colombo family, and they hit in Brooklyn, Queens, and then the Little Italy area of Lower Manhattan. A couple of the social clubs belonged to senior crew bosses in the Gambino crime family, and a third one was a Gambino-linked spot called the Cafe Liberty, and it was robbed by the Uvas twice. supposedly Cafe Liberty had been the scene. I didn't look this up, see if I could figure out a particular brutal interfamily mob killing. I ought to look that up. You guys might go out there and Google Cafe Liberty and see what mob killing happened there. They also robbed the West End Social Club, which was a family, Bonanno family, a consigliere for that family ran that club. And then the Bensonhurst, there was a club called the Bay 16th Street, which Bensonhurst, that's Gotti territory there. But eventually, you know, as with many mob murders, and I worked a few of them myself, you hit a dead end. You just can't, you kind of figure out the story or something about the story, but you just can't put it together to actually charge anybody.
Well, there's no witnesses.
Yeah, no witnesses, nobody's talking.
You have no weapon. Because they always get rid of the weapon.
Right.
Right. Or maybe in this case, because I would think when these guys were robbing these social clubs.
Or they throw the weapon down, you've got the weapon, but you don't have anybody to link to the weapon.
Yeah. But a lot of times these social clubs, somebody would be hanging outside, maybe keeping an eye on things. And so when they come in and they're sort of two-man team robberies where she's the wheel man or wheel woman and he goes in and robs them, that... they're going to get, you know, people in the neighborhood know these social clubs belong to who they belong to. So to me, it would seem pretty, at some point you keep doing this and you live in the same area. Someone's going to go, yeah, you guys got robbed. We know you got robbed. They don't talk about it, but we saw this maroon Mercury Topaz pull away.
And they might even say, well, I saw that guy. That's Tommy Uva. That was little Tommy Uva. I remember him when he was a little kid. His mother's got a flower shop just around the corner, you know. So, you know, hence, that's how they figured out who did it and knew they had the right people to kill. you can't keep that going forever. Yeah. Not in that small of a world. And it's a, you know, New York's a big city, but this is a much smaller world in the mafia family, and then when you stick to especially the lower Manhattan and then Bensonhurst and Queens over there, it's a really small world.
Well, and you don't want to go out and kill the wrong person and then have somebody show up at another social club, same guy, robbing him again, because now you didn't do the job, which could be a death sentence for you.
Yes, at least in Chicago, for sure it would be. Look at the guys that didn't get our friend Ken Ito, Tokyo Joe kill. They ended up dead themselves shortly thereafter. Well, you know, in regards to those lists, as I was reading some of this stuff, I found a kind of an interesting Gotti thing. John Gotti Jr., who kind of took over the Gotti's place for a while, he didn't last very long. 1997, they were searching his house, and they found a typed list of made members of the Gambino Gotti organization, as well as $348,000 in cash, a list of guests who attended his wedding, along with the dollar amount of their wedding guests, which was more than $350,000. And they also found a list of several men who had been inducted into other families in 1991 and 1992. So for some reason, you talk about mob guys not ever writing anything down. Well, Gotti felt like he needed to write some stuff down too. So Tuffy, don't feel so bad that you took some notes in order to remind yourself of what kind of business you'd been conducting.
Well, maybe it wasn't John, but his son, John Gotti Jr., who wrote all this
right
down.
He's the one that did it. I'm sure his dad's in jail by this time, and he's trying to make it as a mob guy himself. I think he's the guy that supposedly has gone straight that was on 60 Minutes or something like that, I believe. And then it was his son or his nephew that did that arson with Vinny Acero, the Lufthansa heist guy that our friend Tony DiStefano talked about. He got an 8-year sentence for committing an arson on a guy's car and out of a road rage incident. And this Gotti's, John Gotti's Jr.'s son or his nephew or something was involved in that. He also got popped for doing drugs here recently, but I think he beat the case. I remember seeing some. I try to keep up on those things. Hard to keep up on all of it, but I think he beat that case, that youngest Gotti kid on selling narcotics in New York.
It was kind of interesting that they would have the names of other members of the mob from other families.
Yeah, recently inducted, you know, trying to keep track of it, I guess. They say that it enraged Gotti's father as well as all the other bosses. And they said that as I was looking into this, that pretty soon everybody started calling Junior, John Gotti Jr., dumb fella. You've heard of the good fellas, they started calling him dumb fella. or maybe that was just in the media. Who knows where those nicknames come from? It's a good one. But the Bonnie and Clyde Bandits, let's get back to them. That's a little bit of an aside about lists that mob guys keep. Tommy and Rosemarie Uva are dead now. And case is a cold case. 2005, there's a RICO trial, and that's when it all comes out. That's when the screenwriter and everybody, the newspapers reported on it, and they got enough information to then write the screenplay and do that movie. It's 13 years later. Now, you understand all RICO investigations as racketeer-influenced and corrupt organizations. They must have two or more what they call predicate acts. That are acts that kind of get this thing kicked off. And these are any kind of criminal acts. It can be extortion, murder, assault, prostitution, gambling. But it's got to tie directly back to the accused person and who is a member of the accused organization. And in this case, one of the predicate acts was this double murder of Tommy and Rosemarie Uva.
Well, they certainly had a list of folks that were associates to the Gambino crime family.
Yeah, they've
and
got
then
that.
A few others there, thanks to John Gotti Jr.
Thanks to dumb fella.
And, well, they had that list before from the Wallace.
Oh, from the Wallace, too. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I forgot about that one. So the target in this that was a Gambino capo, his name was Dominic Skinny Dom Pizzona. They called him Skinny Dom because there was a fat Dom out there, too. You know, and many times you'll have a, you know, like I remember the two guys I was telling you about. One of them was a source of mine. They called him Fingers because he was so good with cards, and so he had a son that would hung out with him all the time. And they called his son Toes, so it was Fingers and Toes. You'd go to a joint where one of them or the other one hung out, you'd say, "Well, Fingers and Toes been around," and they'd know exactly who you were talking about. I can't remember the real names now. Skinny Dom was 63-year-old guy, gray haired. A lot of these guys, they never really focused much in school, and he couldn't read or write. They determined as they were doing some of his background investigation. He was arrested under RICO, racketeering. He's in jail. He was in charge. They were figured out from, I think, some wiretaps or something they'd done. He was in charge of all the Gambino crime family gambling activities. He's probably good with numbers, not so good with reading and writing.
Yeah, well, he didn't write anything down. He had great memory.
They also accused him of participating for John Gotti, who ordered this murder in the Big Paul Castellano murder. And they also killed his underboss at the same time. They're in front of Sparks Steakhouse in Manhattan. That's when John Gotti ascended to being the boss of the Gambino family. There was another murder, the Frank Boccia murder, and the two Uva murders. Frank Boccia murder is kind of an interesting murder. It's a scene directly out of The Sopranos. He was killed because he slapped his mother-in-law around a little bit, and she was the wife of a good friend and confidant and member of the Gotti organization named Anthony Ruggiano. But here's kind of art and life imitates art, or art imitates life. There's one scene in the Sopranos where they take this guy out on Tony Soprano's fishing boat, kill him, and then dump him out in the ocean. So the killers of Frank Boccia disposed of his body at sea after taking him out on one of their own pleasure crafts, their own little sport fishing boats. Also in 1992, they accused Pizzona of participating in the murder, as I said before, of Thomas Uva and his wife Rosemary. It said Gotti had ordered this murder. He was particularly enraged because he had twice robbed the Bergen Fish.
Bergen's Hunting Fish.
Thank you.
Club.
And Piazzonia had managed that club. So, and in the movie, they showed this one guy who he like teased him about having perfect hair and being the kind of the perfect looking Italian, and he came back around a couple of times, so it'd be like the Pizzonia character, I think, in the movie. They said in December 24th, New Year's or Christmas Eve, 1992, Bozzoni and another mobster friend of his named Ronnie Truccio had located the Uvas and were following them when they came up behind them and they were stopped at a traffic light and there wasn't anybody around right then. He just jumped out and ran up and killed them. Now, the government or the G, you know, they call the government the G. I've heard that on wiretaps before and among themselves. You know, what's the G doing? How many how many witnesses does the G has? The G, what's the G up to now? I had two key witnesses. There was a guy called Mickey Scars, Michael DiLeonardo. He was a captain in the Gambino crime family. He's a bookmaker and a loan shark. And he also had been a killer for him. And a guy named Salvatore Vitale, who was the underboss of the Bonanno crime family. And he'd been an informant for several years by that time. They, as a matter of fact, they claimed that, hindsight, that he was one of the most productive informants against the mafia in New York that the government had ever used. And they for some reason, they upped these guys. They brought them forward to solve these murders and take out our friend Pisonia. And also, Vitale's testimony was supported by information provided by another Bonanno capo named Frank Leno. So they really, guys were ratting each other out and testifying all over the place in New York and at this point in time in 2013. The government was able to prove that John Gotti Jr., who we mentioned before, had that list. He had gotten confirmation from John Gotti Sr., who was in prison, to go ahead and have the Uvas killed. I guess they'd probably, more than likely, they'd figured out who they were, kind of had them spotted where they lived and where they might hang out. But then you got to get the approval of the boss to kill somebody like that. Mob guys don't kill just on the whim or just because they're mad at somebody. If they're going to kill somebody, you got to have the approval of the boss.
Well, they'd, I would think, have to kind of determine who they were, if they were in any way associated with any of the other crime families.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Be another.
And follow them around. And
be an earner for one of the other crime families.
Yeah.
Shoot, you don't want to kill that dude unless they don't mind. They want him killed, too.
Unless you get permission.
Yeah. This thing got a little bit crazy as they got into it. These mob guys are something else. According to testimony from Vitale, Junior Gotti had told the Bonanno boss, Joe Massino, that there'd been rumors going around that Bonanno soldiers, Anthony Donato, who is not our guy, Donato, and Vincent Bassiano.
Not DiDonato.
He would have mentioned this, too. If he had gotten involved in this thing, he probably would have mentioned it. Anyhow, that they were going around telling everybody that they're the ones that killed the Uvas. And he said Gotti Jr. was telling this Bonanno leader, no, you guys didn't kill him. We killed him. It was our skinny Dom that did that job, he supposedly told this guy. And several informants testified it was our trophy. So I don't know, what would you compare that to, Aaron? They're arguing about who actually killed the Uvas.
I could see that they might want to take the credit for that because, you know, they weren't just hitting the Gambinos, you know, the Bonannos were getting hit too, you know, and so they're going, these guys are really pretty brazen to live in a neighborhood where the Gambinos live, driving around, having robbed their social clubs in the same area, and then, you know, at least go down the street and, you know, go across the river.
Really? Go down to New Jersey and rob the Sopranos at Satrials.
Not that it's any safer, because, you know, when they figure out who you are, you're dead.
You're dead. Suicide by mob. Not suicide by cop. Suicide by mob. Mr. Pisonia got convicted in May of, I said 2013, it's 2007. He got convicted in May of that year in several racketeering charges, and particularly he was on the charge of conspiracy to commit the murder of the Uvas.
He was only charged with the conspiracy and not the actual murder?
Well, that's what my information had, that he was convicted of the charge of conspiracy on that. Maybe they convicted the other guy, the murderer, or maybe they had enough to convict him that he was talking about it, that he put everything in motion to go do it. And then when the act actually happened, that would be enough to charge you with, get you with conspiracy, because it was a racketeering charge, see? Yeah. Because that's why they hate RICO and racketeering charges, because you don't really have to convict people of those predicate offenses. You just have to show that more than likely they did it and they were part of a conspiracy to make money for the organization. That's why somebody like Ken Ito was so important to bring him in and say, this guy is the boss, this guy is a lieutenant, this guy is an underboss, this guy is a capo, this guy is a leads a crew, and he answers to this guy, and this guy answers to this guy. That's why those kinds of people are really important, because it's a huge, big case, and you got to put all those parts together to get any convictions. And they hate that because you don't have to convict them of the actual murder.
Well, and they don't get charged with the murder. I mean, again, it's kind of witnesses or people would say they're the ones that did the murder, but they don't have the weapon.
Yeah, right, right.
There's not a lot of physical evidence other than the bodies.
Yep, you're right. You're exactly right on that one. He was found not guilty on this 1988 Boshia murder where they disposed of the guy at sea.
I wonder how they found that guy. Did he wash up?
Probably. Either that or somebody probably testified. Maybe they never found his body. That's probably why he got found not guilty. Probably somebody testified, yeah, he did that. I was there when he did that.
How much time did that say it again?
Pizzonia actually only ended up with pleading guilty and to a gambling charge, and then they got one single act of conspiracy. But that got him convicted of racketeering, and that got him 15 years in the joint. Matter of fact, he's going to be getting out here pretty quick. He's 80. He'll be 80 years old when he gets out. That'll be in 2020, and this is, 2018. So he'll be out in a couple of years. He's up in Otisville, which is just north of New York City, not too far away.
Maybe we ought to send him a letter.
Send him a letter.
See if we can put some money on his, make a call.
I doubt if he wants to talk to us. But you never know. The Boonie Hat Bandit didn't mind talking to us. I put some money on his books. I got to send a message to his wife and see if he's got. I was thinking maybe Christmas stories from Christmas in the prison. What do you think?
Well, it's a little late for that.
Well, but it's not like we're going to get anything real time out of him. I'm just trying to think of something that would be interesting to people out of the penitentiary. I don't know what all he's got. I don't want him to say anything that could come back and hurt him, because you don't know who's listening to these things, and could be a relative. He starts telling some other story out of the prison that somebody takes offense at, and we got one of the relatives that heard on this, then...
Or somebody who's maybe works in the prison system, because he's already gotten in trouble for basically bashing the prison system.
Yeah, that's true. He didn't want to bash it too bad.
He can tell stories of how they share, they break bread and share toilet bowl wine at
Exactly.
Christmas.
Well, he probably didn't want to talk about the toilet bowl wine. I'm just thinking about it, what do you do when you're in the joint at Christmas? They, guards have a Christmas tree, I don't know. I mean, those are the kinds of things I'm interested in. What are the day-to-day life activities of people? We can get it from a first-hand account from him anyhow. I need to do that.
It would be good to get him on the phone.
Yeah.
Just to do that as a phone, it would be an interesting phoner.
That's what I said, that I gave him some money to put on his book so he can then pay for phone calls, and we can get him on the phone and call in. I don't know. See, we can't call him.
He's got to call us.
He's got to call us, so we'd have to do it outside the studio here.
Yeah, that would be a little more difficult.
Right.
The studio kind of blocks the cell service, so you can't just give him your number and have him call that.
Right. I'll probably just have him call me at home here one of these days and just tape it, and then we'll just listen to it.
Record it on your phone.
Do some commentary on it, yeah. Anyhow, so that's the end of the Uvas and the end of the guy that killed him. So it's a heck of a story. I would highly recommend you go watch that movie, folks.
Now, does the movie end the same way?
No, the movie ends with their end. The movie does not go into all this other.
It doesn't continue along. It doesn't speculate who the actual murderers are.
No. While this is fresh information about the conspiracy against Skinny Dom Pizzonia, which that's why I've cut this up into two, because it was like a whole separate story in a way that, what they did is kind of interesting and fun, but then how did he actually get somebody that did that kind of murder? And they got him. Because, it's really hard to solve those kind of mob murders with no witnesses.
Yeah.
That's a difficult one.
Unless the family start arguing and saying, well, no, we killed him.
Exactly. like a bunch of high school boys. Which, is there some truth to that? Maybe a little bit socially immature in some ways, the sports, particularly the street level guys, and then this gaudy junior people and all that. Never really have a chance to grow up and learn your normal social graces. If you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase on Amazon for just $7. And then after you're done watching that, you're going to be really excited and want to learn more, and you're going to be able to, because you're going to want to go get the Kansas City Mob Tour app for $1.99. You can download your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And then if that's not enough, Gary has a book he just released called Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination in Las Vegas. And Gary took the time to go through the wiretaps that they used to convict them, distilling it down to the most salient points. And it's in a book, but it's not only in a book, it's in a Kindle app. As a Kindle book, there's hyperlinks to the video files with transcriptions and the actual audio from the mouth of the men that did it.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music. From their album, Read a Book, this is Odd-O-Matic's song, A Fifth in the Fifth, on Gangland Wire.